Today is June 9th, 2017, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexiou in Washington, D.C. Coming up, former FBI Director James Comey admits to releasing information to the media.
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the president as a private citizen.
Also ahead, what's going on in Britain? Political uncertainty. And what is the future of Brexit? President Trump is back on Twitter. And later, the best young pianists compete for the Van Cliburn Gold. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump staying off Twitter for a day while listening to former FBI Director James Comey testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. But the president took today to his social media and went off on Twitter to claim exoneration and to say that Comey is, quote, a leaker. Trump referring to Comey's release of memos that Comey took of conversations he had with the president. Comey gave a friend his notes, who then gave or leaked them to the media. He did so after hearing the president say at one point there might be tapes of their conversations. Here's a question and answer between Comey and Senator Blunt in yesterday's hearing on the release of those memos. Blunt speaks first.
What kind of information did you give to a friend?
That the Flynn conversation, that the president had asked me to let the Flynn, I mean, I'm forgetting my exact own words, but the conversation in the Oval Office.
So you didn't consider your memo or your sense of that conversation to be a government document? You considered it to be somehow your own personal document that you could share with the media as you wanted to?
Correct.
Through a friend?
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the president as a private citizen. I felt free to share that. I thought it very important to get it out.
Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee was his first chance to speak in public about the meetings and conversations that he had with President Trump during the months before he was fired. Renato Mariotti is a former federal prosecutor in Chicago who has handled many obstruction cases. He's now a partner at the law firm Thompson Coburn, but he gives his assessment of James Comey's testimony.
Mr. Comey came off as credible. He certainly had a very vivid recollection of all of the conversations that he had with the president. He clearly took very detailed notes, and he described his method of doing so and why he did so. So I found him to be credible. He also, I think, provided important detail that I think Bob Mueller will take a very close look at in his investigation when he's evaluating the intent that the president had during his conversation or alleged conversation with Mr. Comey regarding dropping the Flynn investigation. That said, it's clear that, at least so far, that there's no smoking gun, that this is there is a lot of inferences that will have to be drawn regarding the president's intent, and that is often the case in an obstruction investigation, but it is often a difficult thing to prove in court and requires a lot of evidence from multiple sources.
So the argument would be for those who think there is some sort of an obstruction of justice or something illegal going on, at least as far as the Flynn situation is concerned, it was that Comey had confirmed that the president had expressed his, quote, hope that that Comey would drop the FBI's investigation into Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, the former national security advisor. So when the president said that, does that meet any sort of legal definition of obstruction of justice in any way?
So Mr. Comey testified that he believed that that was a direction and at one point said that that was an order from the president.
Yes.
So an order from the president to stop an investigation could be obstruction if the president was acting with a corrupt intent, if he was acting corruptly, in other words, for an improper or unlawful purpose. And to determine whether he had that intent would require a prosecutor like Mr. Mueller to look at all the facts and circumstances of the case. So I would expect him to look at the surrounding circumstances, for example, the dismissal of other people from the room, but also the subsequent firing of Mr. Comey and all the circumstances surrounding that, which are not fully public at this point.
Okay, so but the president does have the constitutional power, does he not, to tell the FBI director if he wanted him to stop a particular case. He has that power, does he not?
He certainly does. So, but you can do things that are within your constitutional power that are nonetheless obstruction of justice if you do them with an improper purpose. So, for example, if the president, if his member of his family was under investigation, or his friend, Mr. Flynn, was under investigation, and he told the FBI to shut down the investigation because I like this person and I don't want to see them go to jail, that could be obstruction of justice.
Mariotti says a prosecutor would obviously need more evidence of the president's intent, but he does believe there is what he calls an unusual fact pattern, he says, surrounding the investigation. Well, now, getting back to the social media and the president, getting back on Twitter and more on social media is Andrew Pachesky to tell us what's out there. What do we got going on now?
Well, 2,753 minutes. That was the amount of time that President Trump went without tweeting, and that became the story in and of itself. After many people anticipated that he was going to be live tweeting potentially the Comey hearings, we didn't hear from him. He tweeted on Wednesday morning and did not tweet again until early this morning at about 6:10 a.m. And of course, that tweet about Comey, saying that Comey is a leaker despite so many false statements and lies, total and complete vindication. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing that a lot of people picked up on, and I think it's amazing that people have been able to figure these things out, Trump came within 3 minutes of having the longest Twitter drought since announcing his candidacy for president. But this drought, if you will, was actually the longest that he's had during his presidency. So almost a full 48 hours, just under 46 hours, he went without tweeting.
So he did not break his record. He just came close to it.
Did not break the record, but came close. Lots of people saying that it was maybe the White House staff took away his phone, trying to not get him to tweet during that Comey hearing. But even now that he is reacting to it, a lot of people saying that what he said is troubling. He's accusing Comey of lying under oath, which is a crime. So they're saying that accusation is very troubling. That might be something they need to investigate.
Right. And now what? There's other news now. There's a lot going on over in Britain.
There is a surprise election result in a hung parliament. Conservatives actually losing seats when they thought they were going to pick up seats in that general election. Experts saying that social media actually made the difference for the Labour Party. It helped them get young people out to vote. That was the difference maker for them, and they were able to pick up some seats. But lots of interesting moments and memes, particularly when they announced the results. You have some interesting characters that run for office in Britain. For example, people like Lord Buckethead, which is exactly what you sounds like, a man with a bucket on his head. Members of the Monster Raving Loony Party, and Mr. Fishfinger was a man dressed up as a fish stick. So you have those people standing alongside people like Prime Minister Theresa May, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. Makes for some interesting stuff, but as they say, politics can be strange bedfellows.
It certainly can, and social media certainly has enhanced our coverage of politics, and it certainly makes it a lot more fun.
I'll tell you what, I did not know about the Monster Raving Loony Party before I went on Twitter last night to check the results of the election, so I guess it's working.
The Monster Raving what is it?
Monster Raving Loony Party.
Loony Party. Well, yes. Maybe we can go to that this weekend. We'll see. All right. Thanks a lot, Andrew Pachesky. It is 14 minutes past the hour. You're listening to International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, Venezuela's attorney general challenging a plan to rewrite the Constitution. Global climate leadership might prove costly for China. Southeast Asia urging to step up cooperation in the fight against cybercrime. And new U.S. sanctions on Iran could be just the start. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May gambled and she lost. Thinking she was going to strengthen her party's power, she made the decision to call a snap election, seeking to strengthen her hand in the European Union negotiations and further sideline her political critics. But in a matter of months, what was a 20-point lead in the polls seemed to evaporate. Today, she vows to stay in power and try to push forward with what surely are going to be some trying and difficult talks on Britain's exit from the EU. But she'll have to do it now with a weaker Conservative Party, which has now put the country in what some say is a political tailspin. And standing outside of her office at 10 Downing Street, she said she will now form a government.
What the country needs more than ever is certainty. And having secured the largest number of votes and the greatest number of seats in the general election, it is clear that only the Conservative and Unionist Party has the legitimacy and ability to provide that certainty by commanding a majority in the House of Commons. As we do, we will continue to work with our friends and allies in the Democratic Unionist Party in particular.
Talks with the European Union actually begin in just a few days. Meantime, Labour's John McDonnell says Labour is prepared to form a minority government and put forward a Queen's speech, adding that it's up to the other parties whether they will support it. But he says May was rejected because she put party advances before country.
It was a vote of no confidence in this Prime Minister, her calling of this election, and her refusing to debate the real issues that are affecting working people in this country. And I don't believe the Tories are in a position now to form a stable government or have this Prime Minister remain in office.
McDonnell says a minority party can set a new tone going forward, and it would put forth popular policies that members of Parliament can accept, one that he says they would not want to be seen voting against.
This is Science in a Minute.
In his 1915 theory of general relativity, physicist Albert Einstein proposed that mass can bend space-time. He predicted that when a distant star's light passed by a large object en route to the observer, the object's gravity can bend and brighten the starlight like a magnifying glass. This effect, called gravitational lensing, was confirmed in 1919 by English astrophysicist Arthur Eddington. Nearly 100 years later, a group of astronomers have confirmed Einstein's theory once again, after successfully replicating Eddington's experiment with a Hubble Space Telescope. The researchers used gravitational lensing to precisely calculate the mass of a white dwarf star some 17 to 19 light years away. The remains of a burnt-out regular star were measured to have a mass equal to about 68% of our own sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
A group of Native American activists from the Sioux Tribe of Standing Rock, North Dakota, say they're going global with their fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. With more on that, we go to Lisa Schlein.
Native American protesters have failed in their quest to stop the flow of oil through the Dakota Access Pipeline. Drilling began on June 1st. While they may have lost this battle, the activists say the war is far from over. They say they plan to hit corporations and banks where it hurts most, in their wallet. Rachel Heaton is a member of the Muckleshoot tribe and an indigenous leader in Seattle. She is one of four water protectors touring various countries and cities in Europe to drum up support for their cause.
We're going around and sharing our stories, as well as talking to the banks here in Europe that are invested in the fossil fuel projects on our lands. We're here to ask the banks to divest from the fossil fuel projects, as they are contributing to the genocide of our people, the environmental racism that continues to take place, as well as the violation of our treaty rights.
Oglala Sioux activist and hip-hop artist Natani Means, representing indigenous people, appealed to the UN Human Rights Council to hold the United States to account for what he described as brutality faced by protesters at Standing Rock. Means tells VOA he was one of nearly 800 water protectors arrested on what he calls bogus charges. He says the police entered tribal lands and arrested the protesters in violation of treaty rights with the federal government.
They came into our land. We were camped out on the pipeline route. They came and they forcefully removed us as we were unarmed. And I was arrested along with 170 other water protectors that day. I was arrested that day for standing for water. And I went in a nonviolent way, and I'm still fighting those charges today.
At the council, Means called on the Special Investigator on Freedom of Assembly and Peaceful Protest to visit the United States in order to investigate these human rights violations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in Washington, I'm Philip Alexio. This is International Edition.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Well, thanks to an explosion of bike share apps and providers, China's rediscovering its love for bicycles. In cities across the country and in the capital of Beijing, a colorful bike share revolution is taking over on the streets, helping to ease traffic snarl and keeping the air cleaner. It's also creating some problems. China used to be called the Kingdom of Bicycles, and though cars have taken over in a major way, the growing popularity of the bike share app seems to indicate two-wheelers are making a comeback. Now, for some drab and dusty Beijing, the bike share color revolution of yellows and oranges and blues is a welcome sight. People of all ages are enjoying the convenience that the bikes provide, which combines cell phone technology and GPS tracking in some cases to help the users find a ride. And traveling by car across the sprawling, densely populated city is often a nightmare. Even short distances of a few kilometers can take up to an hour when traffic is snarling. Then there's the Great Wall of Bikes. With a growing number of bike providers, competition's getting increasingly fierce, and one key tactic by providers has been to flood the streets with bikes, so much so that sidewalks are almost entirely blocked in some cases. Well, every 4 years, young pianists from around the world, they flock to Fort Worth, Texas for the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition. Now, this week, at the 15th edition of the Cliburn Competition, the original field of 30 competitors has been winnowed down to 6, and the winners, they'll be announced on Saturday evening. Gail Wine has the story in Fort Worth, Texas.
More than half a century ago, international relations between the United States and Russia warmed when a tall, soft-spoken young Texan pianist claimed first prize at the prestigious International Tchaikovsky Competition in Moscow. Not long after, the piano competition that bears his name, Van Cliburn, was founded, attracting outstanding talent from around the globe to compete for the coveted gold, silver, and bronze medals every 4 years. 25-year-old Rachel Cheung from Hong Kong is one of the 6 finalists.
I'm sure it will be life-changing because this is the biggest competition in the world, and the engagements that would bring on with winning it would be very, very helpful to my career, and there will be a lot of opportunities and exposures.
American Daniel Hsu says that being a finalist at the Van Cliburn competition is a bit surreal.
Even though it's a competition and, you know, there's a lot of stress and preparation, but the overall feeling is just incredible, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm having a blast.
Leonard Slatkin, conductor and chairman of the jury, says that the Cliburn competition, one of more than 200 piano competitions in the world, is an important one.
Clearly, the Cliburn is the premier competition in the United States. It attracts the highest level. The Cliburn ranks in a similar manner as, say, the Queen Elizabeth or the Tchaikovsky in terms of the international prestige it brings.
All of the competitors have played concerts, but for some, including Georgi Chiidze, a 29-year-old finalist from Russia, playing in a competition is different from an ordinary performance.
It's all about pressure. Pressure is so high that sometimes you forget to enjoy the music. And music making is all about enjoying it and to bring the joy and to pass it to the audience, you know.
A On the other hand, Daniel Hsu says he doesn't approach a competition performance any differently from a concert.
I've heard people say that, you know, in competitions you should be more careful and you should try and play for the jury. I didn't particularly take that approach for this competition. I mean, in the end, it's just a couple of performances, right?
No matter what the outcome of the competition, qualifying for the Clyburn validates their dedication to a life in music, says South Korean pianist Ji-kwon Sun-woo.
I guess my passion and love for music is just, I guess, deep enough, and I can never get enough of it. So you have to spend a lot of hours and really such dedication to it.
Leonard Slatkin explains that the band Clyburn is not the be-all and end-all to a career.
Because a competition shouldn't be the beginning and end of it. It should be just one possible step among many paths that the pianist can take. They wouldn't have gotten this far if they weren't good enough to be at the Clyburn.
The winner of the Van Clyburn competition earns a cash prize and 3 years of professional concert management. But no matter who takes home the gold, all of the competitors in the Van Clyburn International Piano Competition are winners, having had the opportunity to perform for audiences worldwide through global webcasts. For VOA News, I'm Gail Wine at the Van Clyburn Competition in Fort Worth, Texas.
All right, fantastic, Gail. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. You can also like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter, too, at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There has been a dramatic erosion of constitutional rule in Venezuela over the last 18 months. This includes the undermining of the authority of the democratically elected National Assembly, the thwarting of the recall referendum late last year, the ongoing imprisonment of opposition leaders and members of civil society, and other restrictions on individual freedoms, including the use of military tribunals to try civilians, the violent repression of peaceful protests, and most recently, the effort to hold a constitutional assembly to override the will of the Venezuelan people and erode Venezuelan democracy. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon, in remarks at the Organization of American States, decried the humanitarian hardships that have overwhelmed a majority of Venezuelans. Economic stagnation has given way to hyperinflation and increasing economic instability. Venezuelan citizens struggle to maintain basic access to most food and medicine. The United States has condemned the Venezuelan government's violent crackdown against opposition leaders and civil society. In the past 2 months of protests, more than 60 people have been killed, more than 1,000 injured, and nearly 3,000 detained, including 331 civilians charged criminally by military courts. Undersecretary Shannon said the rights of peaceful assembly and peaceful protest ought to be protected and not repressed. The U.S. urges the Venezuelan government to fulfill its commitments to promote free elections, respect the independence of the National Assembly, respect the freedoms of all of Venezuelans' political prisoners, and meet the humanitarian needs of the Venezuelan people. The Organization of American States can partner with others in the international community to help bring about a peaceful resolution to the political impasse in Venezuela. The United States supports a proposal for the establishment of a contact group to guide the next stage of diplomatic efforts. Now is the time for the community of democracies to show the world that inter-American solidarity can help find a path back to peace and prosperity in Venezuela.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.